Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since the 1940s, antibiotics have saved lives by reducing illnesses and death from bacterial infections. But in recent years, their overuse has caused them to become less effective. Common infections, such as urinary tract infections, pneumonia, and gonorrhea, are becoming harder to treat. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that about 2 million people a year get sick from antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and 23,000 die. According to a recent report from the World Health Organization, a post-antibiotic era in which common infections and minor injuries can kill is a very real possibility for the 21st century. Overuse is one of the main problems. According to the CDC, U.S. doctors prescribe enough antibiotics to give them to 4 out of 5 Americans every year. And if they're used for things they can't treat, they can stop working against bacteria when you really need them. The other problem is overuse in livestock. Up to 80% of all antibiotics sold in the U.S. are given to animals to prevent sickness and to force them to grow faster. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how we should be using antibiotics. Also, why is there such widespread overuse? How is that creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria? And what are the solutions? Today, we're joined by Dr. Mike Bell, Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. The division promotes the protection of patients and healthcare personnel, including preventing antimicrobial resistance. Hi, Dr. Bell. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. Patty coordinates the food team and a campaign to get Congress to pass a law to stop factory farms from feeding healthy animals antibiotics. Hi, Patty. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So, Dr. Bell, why don't we start off with the basics? Can you describe an antibiotic to us? What is it exactly?
So, antibiotics are chemicals that interfere with how bacteria grow and multiply. They can either poke holes in the outer wall of the bacteria, which damages the organism, or they can prevent the chemical process that the bacteria uses to multiply and make more of itself. Both of those sorts of general categories exist. They do this while not causing harm to people, so it has to be a selective chemical. There are many things that will kill bacteria that will also kill us. Antibiotics are that sweet spot where they don't harm us, or at least not too much, while they cause the bacteria to die.
How important have they been since the 1940s?
Well, you mentioned this in the introduction, but they've been an absolute game changer. If you look historically, more people died, for example, in the Civil War from infected cuts than they did of bullets or bombs. If you think back to the days when farm injuries led to amputations, not necessarily because the leg was crushed, but because the infection was so bad that the only way to save the person's life was to remove the limb, those were commonplace things. Most of us today have grown up in an era when antibiotics have been available to treat things. And so, you know, children don't die of ear infections. Strep throat doesn't lead to heart disease. It's a fascinating and abrupt change in how we as human beings have been able to thrive. If we don't have them, it becomes a very different picture indeed.
When did we start seeing the overuse of antibiotics?
You know, I think if you turn it around and say, when did we start seeing resistance, it's illustrative. We started seeing resistance to the original penicillins within a year or two of release of the drug. And that same pattern has repeated with every new drug that's come out. In terms of overuse, there's probably always been some overuse. I think the scale of it is probably greater today than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
What are your thoughts on what we're hearing now from a number of health organizations and medical associations warning of a public health crisis because we are overusing antibiotics?
Yeah, I think it can't be overstated. I agree completely that there is a cliff that we're approaching that is going to be a disaster for human healthcare if we aren't very careful. The reality is that we now have a small proportion of bacteria, not very many of them, but enough to be very concerning, that are completely untreatable. This means that we're back to the era of, you know, aspirin and cold towels on your forehead in terms of what we're able to do to directly treat an infection. The supportive care we're able to give today is a little bit better than that, granted. But it's still very alarming to think we can't treat the infection. And if you look at the new drugs in the pipeline, we're probably 6 to 10 years away from anything truly new.
And we'll talk about that throughout the hour. But Patty, I wanted you to also weigh in on this. Do you think people understand how serious this is?
Well, I think, in our experience, people are starting to. I mean, we focus more on the food side of things. It's one major use of antibiotics is in agriculture, which I don't think most average people are aware of unless you're involved in agriculture. But I think that people are now starting to know someone who had an infection that didn't respond to the first drug they tried. I think the effect is more widely known. You know, we've communicated with the folks that are in touch with us and said, hey, do you know somebody that's had this problem? And a lot of people are writing back and saying, yes, I had this problem. Someone in my family had this problem. You know, people are hearing more about things like MRSA, which is one example of an antibiotic-resistant bacteria that more and more people are kind of having an encounter with or know someone who did. So I think the effect is more widely known. What I think we lag is in people understanding how we got here.
Can you tell us more about MRSA?
Sure. So, but also, our other guest is probably better qualified than I am. But, MRSA is an acronym, and the R is for resistance, right? So this is a staph bacteria, so it's something you would find in your skin, but it's a particular strain of the bacteria that's resistant to methicillin, which is an antibiotic. So I think people are hearing more about it in places they don't think about infections, locker rooms and things like that, where people have some, opening on their skin, they get exposed to this particular type of bacteria, and then when they go to get it treated, it's not responding.
And Dr. Bell, according to the CDC, common infections like urinary tract infections, gonorrhea, pneumonia are becoming harder to treat. What are you hearing from doctors from patients across the country? What's most common right now? Does any one thing or two things stand out?
Well, there are a number of things. Getting back to MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph, that was a beautiful answer, by the way. That is something that started out in hospitals because antibiotic use is concentrated there. And we started to see staph infections that were resistant to methicillin. This is, two decades ago. And over the course of that time, that organism and that trait has gradually moved out to the community so that now you can't necessarily rely on penicillins to treat staphylococcus, even if it's somebody who never had contact with the healthcare system. And that sort of pattern of evolving and spreading resistance is something that we see time and again. Today, in addition to the burden of staph that's tough to treat, in the community, and by tough to treat, just to be clear, with the other medications, you could give somebody an oral medication, a bottle of pills to take to treat their abscess or their skin infection. Today, because of MRSA, it's safer and in many places necessary to bring the patient in and give them intravenous vancomycin because that's the best drug left to treat the staphylococcus with. So that kind of impact is something that isn't too obvious, but to the patient who ends up having to spend a few nights in the hospital rather than just going home with pills, it's a big deal.
So it seems like there are two things here, according to the reports that focus on this issue. You've got doctors over-prescribing antibiotics, and we'll get into that in a minute. You also have an overuse in livestock. Between 70 and 80% of all antibiotics in the U.S. are given to animals to prevent sickness and force them to grow faster. Dr. Bell, are there any other reasons why we're seeing so much resistance?
So those two factors are important, and there are a couple more. One is the globalization of our world. There are many places where antibiotics are freely handed over across the counter without a prescription. And places like that can rapidly increase resistance. And then there are also places where, similar to the U.S., antibiotics are used a great deal in livestock. And that also is something that can affect us even across borders and at a distance. So the ability of people to travel and move around is also adding to this, especially when you think about things like medical tourism.
And Patty, is there anything else you would add?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we end up explaining a lot when we're talking to, you know, folks that live all over the place is, well, I don't live near agriculture. I live in a city, or I don't buy meat, so what happens to livestock doesn't apply to me. This, you know, this practice of using these drugs as part of the regular routine of raising animals, usually on larger farms in more, you know, tightly packed, tougher conditions, is a perfect breeding ground for the natural selection process to create bacteria that are no longer going to die when they're exposed to these drugs. But the bacteria don't stay put. They end up out in the environment. They're either carried off that facility by people who work there or go out in the community. The waste from those facilities ends up in the environment. It's spread on fields. It ends up in water. And now there's more research showing that the bacteria can teach each other how to be resistant, that they can trade the genetics that let them have the resistance gene, and they don't stay put. So it doesn't matter if you're a vegan who lives 1,500 miles, you know, from the closest livestock production facility. These are now out there. We've created these bacteria, and they're in the environment, and we need to stop adding to that pool of resistant bacteria that are out there.
It's kind of amazing to think that almost 80% of all antibiotics in the U.S. are given to animals to prevent sickness and to force them to grow faster. When did this begin?
There's a, you know, this kind of gradual stages. All kinds of things get fed to animals to try to make them put weight on a little faster, or to deal with a change in their conditions if you're, you know, keeping them inside or keeping a lot of them in one place. So it's been going on for several decades. Different drugs got the okay at different times. And this is the other thing that we like to point out, is this isn't that each pig walks up in the morning and gets their daily dose of antibiotics in an individual manner. We're talking about adding them to their water and their food in kind of a broadcast way, routinely, often at low levels, but constant. And it's not about, we're not talking about treating animals when they're sick. We're talking about this routine use. It's called non-therapeutic use. And there's different timelines of when the advice became, we'll try this drug for this problem or not a problem, or this drug seems to make them grow faster. And, you know, we're now several decades into this, but experts have been warning that this is a perfect environment to create resistance since the 70s. You know, people were raising the alarm. There's been petitions that have been sent to the Food and Drug Administration, you know, 35 years ago, saying don't let them use, you know, penicillins or some other class of antibiotics for this non-therapeutic use, and we haven't seen that action. So this is not a new phenomenon. It's just one that hasn't been tackled for a long time.
And for people who eat animals, how can they find out if what they're eating is also eating antibiotics?
It's a good question. I mean, one clear guidepost that you have is that certified organic meat or milk can't come from animals that were given antibiotics. If those animals were given antibiotics, they come out of the organic program. So that's one label that you can go use. Beyond that, it's a little less regimented. There are some companies who are saying, you know, we don't use antibiotics, and they're conveying that on their label. The one distinction that we do have to make is we're not talking about the antibiotics being in the meat itself. They're supposed to stop giving them a set amount of time before the animal goes to slaughter or before the milk makes it to the market. So we're not talking about whether or not there should be antibiotic residues in the meat. That's illegal. There should not be residues in the meat. We're talking about, was the animal raised using this way? And that's where some of the labeling gets a little tricky.
How is that enforced, though? I mean, how can you be sure that they're not being fed antibiotics right before slaughter?
So there is a monitoring program. There's something called the National Residue Program, which the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA, because the USDA does meat inspection, they're supposed to work together and check for these residues. The FDA also does a milk sampling program, and they do publish those results when there are violations, and there are. They publish those results and say, you know, this is the list of who violated these rules about drug residues.
That is Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of the advocacy group Food and Water Watch. She coordinates the food team and a campaign to get Congress to pass a law to stop factory farms from feeding healthy animals antibiotics. 80% of all antibiotics sold in the United States are given to animals to prevent sickness and to force them to grow faster. We're also joined by Dr. Mike Bell, Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about why we overuse antibiotics. According to the World Health Organization, a post-antibiotic era is a very real possibility for the 21st century. The CDC estimates that about 2 million people a year get sick from antibiotic-resistant bacteria and 23,000 die. So the problem is a lot of common infections are now becoming harder to treat because of overuse. And if you have any questions about antibiotics, what's the best way to take them? And if you've been prescribed antibiotics by your doctor, did you feel like you had the right information? And if you work in the health field, is this an issue that you're talking about? In fact, a number of people say it's time for a public health campaign to publicize this and to educate the public about this issue. What do you think that should look like? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Dr. Bell, what concerns you most about the overuse of antibiotics in animals?
Well, in animals, I think, you know, I would get back to something you just heard, the phrase low levels. Any time you expose a big mixture of organisms to low levels of an antibiotic, what you do is you either slow down or inhibit, sometimes kill, but mostly slow down the ones that are susceptible, and you give a competitive advantage to the ones that are resistant. And that's how populations of bacteria gradually become more and more able to resist antibiotics. And that's what happens in you and me if, for example, you take a day or a day and a half of an antibiotic rather than a complete prescription to kill the bacteria that you're supposed to be treating. Or worse, if you had leftovers and you think, you know, this runny nose isn't getting better, maybe I'll just take a day or two of antibiotics. That's bad, and it's not bad because of the cold. It's bad because that big group of bacteria in your own gut is being affected by that low dose of antibiotics. Those communities of bacteria are referred to as a microbiome. And they're actually increasingly recognized as being important for human health. In fact, there's early clues that say that depending on what your biome looks like, you may be more predisposed towards obesity. That's interesting when you think about the fact that these antibiotics are being used to make animals fat faster. We could be doing the same things to ourselves when we take these low doses of antibiotics.
Hmm. Jamie in Santa Cruz couldn't stand the line, but he wanted to know if farmers need prescriptions for antibiotics. Patty, do you know?
Well, that's a great question, and that's in flux right now. For years, they did not. For years, these were many and different antibiotics, different classes related to the ones that we take for ourselves when we have an infection. Many of those classes were available over the counter, and they were sometimes even pre-mixed into the feed that farmers would buy for their animals. So there has been, after many, many years, some things in the works at the Food and Drug Administration. They're in charge of animal drugs, too. And they did put out some guidance about 6 months ago that starts to shift to a system where you would need veterinary oversight. So it's not exactly a prescription, but it's moving away from this over-the-counter focus. But we think that there's still more that needs to be done so that we can't just have, you know, a blanket prescription. Like, you can always give these low levels. We would like to see much more clear prohibitions on these low-level uses, these non-therapeutic uses. So what the FDA did was way, way, way overdue to have this conversation about how much veterinary oversight should this stuff be over the counter, but we have a much further to go.
How do these farms decide which antibiotics to give the animals? I mean, is there a specific antibiotic that's targeted to farms? Or how does that work?
Well, many of them are you know, it's not like that there's animal antibiotics and human antibiotics. It's the same, they're the same drugs. They might be some different brand names. There might be some different, you know, dosing levels and things like that given for different purposes. So, you know, there's a large veterinary pharmaceutical industry, and they market these things to the meat industry and to folks, you know, running large factory farms, the same way they market things to human doctors to try to get them to buy the drugs. So there is a process by which, you know, FDA approves a label for that drug about what the conditions are for its use, and that's some of what's being changed right now with the FDA's new directions on this. They're changing some of the uses that are listed on those labels, but the changes don't go far enough to stop all of these low-level non-therapeutic uses. They've still let a lot of them go on.
So for now, the FDA has issued voluntary guidelines calling on animal producers to stop indiscriminately using antibiotics. Is that right?
Right. So about 6 months ago, it was in December, the FDA put out one directive about the veterinary oversight, and they put out some other guidance that basically dealt with how these drugs are labeled for use, right? That's how you govern how a drug is used. You deal with the drug label, which gets approved by the FDA. And there are two kind of categories. There's two terms that you hear when we're talking about these low-level, you know, non-therapeutic uses. One is growth promotion. That, you know, if you feed this drug at this level over time, the animal's going to put on weight faster. So it's just to make them fatter faster, like this thing we heard about. The second non-therapeutic use is disease prevention. And that's not treating a disease. There's some wiggle room there. That's saying I'm giving this in advance to try to prevent a disease from happening. And that's pretty fuzzy. And that's what worries us in this, you know, that you're creating the kind of use in an environment where it's perfectly suited to create resistance. And so in December, FDA said you shouldn't list these drugs for growth promotion anymore. So that's something, but they didn't close that second loophole for non-therapeutics, the disease prevention. That is still allowed. The drug labels can still say it. And just this week, FDA put out an update, and they said everybody agreed to comply. They're not going to list it for growth promotion anymore, but they can still list it for disease prevention.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Jamie. And let's go next to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is very informative. I appreciate it very much. Many years ago, I learned that generally when it comes to dairy farms, when a cow gives birth to a little calf, the calf is immediately taken away from the mother and given other milk, not the mother's milk, because at the time after birth, the cow has the most rich milk that can be used for special cheeses and such.
Right.
And so in order for the calf then to live and flourish, we hope, it is given a fairly large amount of antibiotics. And I heard this, and I was so incensed about it. However, I can't say that I've done much about it, except that I haven't eaten meat for about 35 years. But this is one thing that the poor calf has to be taken off mother's milk. I just think, like, this is something that we could all go out and scream and yell about.
Yes. Well, this is a good question, and I'll ask our guests about this right after the break. We're up against a break. Thank you for calling in, Marie-Louise. Today we are talking about antibiotics and their overuse. The overuse has caused them to become less effective. The Center for Disease Control estimates that 2 million people a year get sick from antibiotic-resistant bacteria. 23,000 die. Up to 80% of all antibiotics in the U.S. are given to animals to prevent sickness and force them to grow faster. And then a new report from the CDC finds that doctors are over-prescribing antibiotics. So what is the best way to use antibiotics, and is it time for a public health campaign? We'll be back after this.
This is your call on local public radio, KALW. If you have a perspective that you've not yet heard in today's discussion, or a question you feel should be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. Or you can post your question or comment on the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that at 12 o'clock today, This American Life with Ira Glass. And then at 1 this afternoon, it's our weekly presentation of Snap Judgment.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had with Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig about his mission to get money out of politics. He recently announced plans to start a super PAC to end all super PACs. So what is the best way to get money out of politics? And then on Friday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had about the really amazing documentary, The Internet's Own Boy. It's about Aaron Swartz, the young technology whiz who took his own life recently after he was facing federal criminal charges for illegally downloading documents from JSTOR. The Internet's Own Boy opens in theaters on Friday, and be sure to check it out. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the best ways to use antibiotics at a time when they are becoming less effective because of overuse. A lot of common infections, pneumonia, gonorrhea, are becoming harder to treat. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that 2 million people a year get sick from antibiotic-resistant bacteria. 23,000 die. And we're talking about this today with Dr. Mike Bell, Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion, and Patty Levera, Assistant Director of the advocacy group Food and Water Watch. She is leading a campaign to get Congress to pass a law to stop factory farms from feeding healthy animals antibiotics. 80% of all antibiotics are now fed to animals. And before we moved on, I wanted to ask Marie-Louise's question, Patty, about the fact that calves are taken from moms when they're born, and so they don't get their mom's milk. They are fed antibiotics and other milk. Can you talk about that?
It's a good example of what I was talking about earlier, of how, you know, there needs to be a system also to make sure that we're not being exposed to antibiotics when we eat meat or milk as well. So one of the, when you look at, you know, FDA does do some sampling to see if that's happening. And one of the themes you see when you look at the who violates, you know, they'll say we had these violations for drug residues. Veal is a recurring theme in that, and veal comes from these calves that are taken off their mother after they're born, because the mother is continuing to produce milk that's sold into the marketplace. And she's absolutely right. They don't, for very long or at all, get their mother's milk. They get something called milk replacer. And sometimes, and I think from what I've read, oftentimes that milk replacer is medicated. And so, you know, we're talking about antibiotics being in their first food. So it's a good example of how, you know, this has now become standard practice. And we're going to have to, you know, when we get to the point where you're not allowed to use antibiotics in this way, people are going to have to change their practices, and it's time to start having that conversation, because it's pretty woven into what's standard in a lot of conventional livestock production, and we need to look to the example of other types of production, folks that have figured out how to do it without antibiotics, organic producers. There's folks in Europe who are not allowed to use antibiotics the way that our meat industry is, and we need to start looking at those examples and start to, you know, get people the technical assistance they need to switch and to stop using these drugs in this way.
So you said that antibiotics are not in meat because they cannot be given to animals right before slaughter, but what about milk?
Well, there's supposed to be a withdrawal. So if you're using a drug in a certain way, you're supposed to be a withdrawal time, and they set it for each drug. And that's, we need FDA to enforce that. And so that's an example of, you know, they had that they have to go out and do the testing and do the sampling. And when they collect milk, most milk processors are supposed to sample for antibiotics as well.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Marie-Louise. Let's go next to Elizabeth in Berkeley. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Thanks so much for the show. It's really very informative. My question is, it has a little background. My daughter came out here recently with her 18-month-old baby, and the baby developed a pretty high fever, and we were having a really hard time bringing it down because we couldn't get her to swallow or keep down any kind of, you know, fever reducer. She was really uncomfortable up all night for several nights, so we finally took her to an urgent care clinic. and saw, you know, wonderful doctors and very knowledgeable, who gave us the choice between either giving her the standard 10-day run of, I think it's probably Ampicillin or something like that, or this sort of silver bullet of one injection of an antibiotic that should, you know, really wipe the thing out in 6 hours. Hmm. And so, of course, we chose the latter, because mainly because of the fact that we didn't think we would be able to get the liquid medicine down her. But my daughter later looked online and was, you know, that particular medication, the fast-acting medication, was said to only be used, you know, in pretty dire cases, mm-hmm. where, you know, like the child had gone septic or something like that. So I was just curious, like, is there any sort of, like, protocol in the medical world or regulation of what doctors prescribe and in what situations, or is it just totally up to the judgment of the doctor?
Well, thank you for the question. Dr. Bell?
Yes. So a couple of things that, you know, I hope the baby got better. I'm trusting she did. There are a couple of things. First of all, we do rely on clinical judgment in terms of which antibiotic is best. We also rely on clinical laboratories to do the tests to inform that. And so we encourage appropriate testing to guide antibiotic use whenever possible. The other issue about what is good and what is bad is something that is in the middle of discussion right now. So as much as we want to respect independent clinician decision-making, we also are setting boundaries on what is and isn't okay. So we're trying to narrow the target zone a little bit. We're doing this because when we studied this in the past year and a half, we found that over 50% of antibiotics prescribed in medical care are either unnecessary or incorrect. And that leaves a lot of room for improvement. So there was an earlier mention of perhaps a public health campaign. I'm happy to tell you that for the past several years, there have been two major public health campaigns called Get Smart. One of them is directed at outpatient doctors and their patients, talking about how to address the desire for antibiotics that often comes in, with somebody with a cold, how to take the time to discuss alternatives, and also sort of giving information to patients to help them feel more comfortable about not having an antibiotic. Similarly, Get Smart within hospitals is to help doctors do a better job of targeting the antibiotic that they're using and making sure they use it for exactly as long as necessary, but not more. The best way to use an antibiotic is to pick one that will kill the bacteria that you're dealing with and use it just as long as it takes to get them all dead. And that's usually a week or two, and then stop immediately.
Why do you think they're being overprescribed and used for things that they shouldn't be used for? I mean, what explains this? Have you had conversations with doctors about this?
Yes. So there are a number of reasons. One is the sheer sort of logistical pressure of taking care of patients in sometimes very busy settings. Mm-hmm. And if there's a strong demand and the patient really, really insists, at a certain point it becomes easier to simply hand over an antibiotic prescription rather than to spend another 15, 20 minutes trying to talk them down. And that's certainly understandable human behavior. I think we're all guilty of going in with a sore throat that probably is viral, but thinking, you know, but I'm planning to travel day after tomorrow. I better go get an antibiotic just in case. That's also normal human behavior. And so we're trying to create a framework and tools to help people get past that. Another phenomenon is sort of the broad coverage approach, where somebody comes in ill and it takes a day or two to have a laboratory result to tell you what to use. And so if they're severely sick, it's best to use something that's going to give you broad coverage of a variety of dangerous bacteria. The plan is supposed to be that within a couple of days you get a result back, and based on that result, you taper down your antibiotic to just the thing that you need. Unfortunately, in many cases, the cultures are never sent. That can be because the antibiotic gets started in a very busy emergency department where there isn't time to do that, or because laboratory resources aren't available. We see that in many parts of the world where the only approach is that empiric approach. when that happens, you don't have a way to back down, so you end up staying on the same drug for a longer period of time, quite possibly unnecessary. If that doesn't do a good job and the patient becomes sicker, the tendency then is to go to the next bigger drug, and that escalating pattern also can drive resistance.
What is the best way to arm yourself with information? Because if you've got an infection or a cold, I mean, obviously you want it to be treated as quickly as possible. And like you said, I mean, we just did a show recently about the shortage of primary care doctors in the United States. And, you know, in many cases, you only have about 10 minutes with your doctor. So you don't have much time to really ask questions. But what is the best way to figure out if an antibiotic is the right course of action to take?
So there are a couple of things. First of all, even if the time is limited, be ready with questions. And if you're somebody who sort of clams up in the clinic, which is pretty darn common, bring a friend to sit with you and ask questions. I think that's very helpful to do, and certainly write them down before you come up. And the questions that I would ask is, is this a bacterial infection that needs antibiotics, or is it most likely viral? That should be, something that your clinician can answer pretty handily. If it's something that they think could be bacterial, then the second question is, are you going to take a culture and test for it, or are you going to just treat empirically? And then finally, how long do I have to be on this, and what are the risks of side effects?
That is Dr. Mike Bell, Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. We're also joined by Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of the advocacy group Food and Water Watch. She coordinates the food team and a campaign to get Congress to pass a law to stop factory farms from feeding healthy animals antibiotics. Up to 80% of antibiotics sold in the U.S. are given to animals to prevent sickness and to force them to grow faster. There's also a new report from the CDC that finds U.S. doctors prescribe enough antibiotics to give them to 4 out of 5 Americans every year. And if they're used for things they can't treat, they can stop working against bacteria when you really need them. And that's the problem we're facing right now. So many common infections are becoming harder to treat. And so if you have any questions about antibiotics, what's your experience with them? If you work in the health field, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Evelyn in Oakland. Hi, Evelyn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for all your shows. And on this one, I just want to put in that I've had some experiences with the opposite ends of the spectrum. The doctors are the ones who control whether you get antibiotics. And if they say, I want to be conservative, I don't want to give too many antibiotics and withhold them, it can be expensive and dangerous. I've been in the hospital because I have not been given antibiotics for pneumonia and so forth. And I've never had a problem with resistance. I don't use antibiotics very often, but every time, penicillin or ampicillin, they work. So especially with the elderly, shouldn't we be careful that they get medication in a timely fashion?
Well, thank you for calling, Evelyn. And stay on the line in case you want to respond. So, Dr. Bell, Evelyn believes that she needs antibiotics, but her doctor's not prescribing them.
Yes. So that was a great comment, and I'm so glad you called. So what we want is for people who need the antibiotic to get it promptly and correctly. We don't want anyone to get sicker or to have a pneumonia progress or, for heaven's sakes, have anybody die of sepsis because they couldn't get an antibiotic. That's not the direction that we want to go in. What we do want to do is make sure that when you get an antibiotic, it's the right one for the right reason and that it's not used for longer than necessary. It's not just resistance that we're worried about here. We have very clear evidence that very bad diseases, especially among the elderly, caused by Clostridium difficile or C. diff, are tightly linked to antibiotic use. We've shown that when you take more antibiotics, you're much more at risk for C. diff, and that disease has gone from more of a nuisance antibiotic-related diarrhea to today, because of the types of toxins that bacteria can carry, a life-threatening disease.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Evelyn. We have an email from Jude in Santa Cruz who says, I'm very glad to hear your show on this issue. One other source of antibiotics and free-floating resistant genes is municipal wastewater. When treated wastewater is used to irrigate food crops, it spreads antibiotic-resistant material and genes to the soil, where they can be taken up into the plants. Tertiary treated wastewater, maybe you can help us with that one, Patty, isn't even permitted to be administered via overhead sprinklers on food crops. I'm wondering what your guests might say about the practice of using treated municipal wastewater to irrigate food crops as a source of antibiotic resistance. Patty, can you take that one?
Sure. So it's a good question, right? Because what goes in comes out. So drugs that people take end up in our wastewater system. And we have, like, I'm sure you've done shows, I'm sure you're hearing about infrastructure. We have a lot of infrastructure improvements that we need to make in our wastewater system. So I think that the email mentioned tertiary treatment, which is you can have, you know, primary, secondary, you know, different levels of sophistication of what you're treating the wastewater for. And a lot of systems in a lot of parts of the country aren't able to treat everything that we put in our wastewater. We put a tremendous range of drugs, different household chemicals, you know, some industrial facilities might be on a public wastewater system, so it's a really important question. You know, we take not only, in some places you take wastewater, and it either ends up in a river or some body of water. In some places it does get reused for irrigation, like it was mentioned, but then we also have the solids. And so sometimes when you make the water cleaner, the wastewater that's coming out, some of those contaminants sometimes then just shift into the solid portion, which is euphemistically called biosolids. Lots of people call it sewage sludge. And that can end up on agricultural land as well. So this is kind of the ultimate example of why we need to prevent some of these exposures that prevent pollution. We shouldn't be putting some of this stuff, if you're talking about, you know, we have a lot of antimicrobial chemicals in antibacterial soap and things like that that can have kind of a parallel phenomenon of teaching or selecting for bacteria that are resistant to those. That stuff ends up in sewage sludge and in wastewater. That's an easy prevention. We do not need to use the volume of antimicrobial things that we do in our household products. It's completely unnecessary. And, you know, there's a question of if we're over-prescribing antibiotics to people, one consequence of limiting that would be that we'd be putting less antibiotics into the sewage system from human waste. So there is absolutely prevention that we could do there if we tighten up how we use these things in the first place.
All right. Well, thank you for the question, Jude. We've got a related question from Dr. Carter, an emergency doctor in Oakland. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello. It's actually Dr. Clements, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry about that.
Middle name, Carter. The question that I had for Dr. Bell is how he feels, what's his feeling about the response in terms of prescribing of antibiotics given the return of pertussis. In California, where I practice, we've seen over the last several years epidemic levels of pertussis. And much of that is probably because people were afraid of another phenomenon, another aspect of healthcare, which was immunization. It was misguided, but unfortunately, when you stop immunizing, then, of course, diseases tend to return. And I do have a comment also about what you guys were just talking about in terms of agricultural waste handling, but let's deal with the question first.
All right. Dr. Bell, do you want to take that first question?
Yes. So this concept, this connected nature of what we're seeing is a great example of an additional unintended consequence of failing to vaccinate. Immunization has prevented so many deaths caused by organisms that otherwise would either not be treatable, some of the viral organisms, or would require antibiotic treatment. pertussis is tricky in particular because it seems like a common cold, so you wouldn't use an antibiotic to begin with. And the antibiotic doesn't really do that much down the road for the chronic cough that can stick around for weeks or months. So it's really a bad match, even though it's caused by a bacterium. It's a bad match for antibiotic use. It's probably the least efficient way of taking care of it. Unfortunately, when people fail to get vaccinated to prevent it, then clusters occur, and children and elderly people in particular are put at tremendous risk. For a healthy adult, pertussis is uncomfortable and very annoying, but it probably won't kill you. But for a very young infant or an elderly person, this can mean weeks in the intensive care unit and even death.
And your second question?
Well, I just had a comment about... I work in a training program for emergency medicine physicians, and I've joked with my residents for years that just as we have farm subsidies, spelled F-A-R-M, we should also have P-H-A-R-M subsidies for antibiotics, where we would basically pay one of the drug companies to take an antibiotic off the market for 18 months to 2 years. And the CDC would then take complete control of a given antibiotic for that period of time. And the only way that you would be able to get it would be to petition the CDC if you needed the drug.
Patty, what do you think of that idea?
I want to hear the guy from the CDC. But, I mean, I've had this conversation a lot. I mean, these are finite resources, and this is kind of a medical example of the tragedy of the commons, right, if we all misuse it. And there's a lot of concern that there's not enough incentive for drug companies to develop new drugs, right, that there's not that many in the pipeline coming up soon, and what incentive do they have to put new ones on the market, because these are not these lifestyle, long-term drugs you take your whole life. Mm. I think there is a very important discussion that has to happen about the incentives, you know, for pharmaceutical companies and what they're doing. We would also prefer that they not be selling the vast quantities they are to agriculture, which is a use we can absolutely do without. So I think it's a balancing act overall about what their incentives are and whether those incentives match up with the public health need that we have for these drugs to work.
Dr. Bell, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, so the incentive issue notwithstanding, I think, you know, there are examples of taking away an antibiotic from the environment for an extended period of time, months or a year, and seeing how the population of bacteria move back to being susceptible. It's sort of an antibiotic resurrection program. And it's something that can work in smaller scale. I think the point that the caller made is important, which is that, you know, if you have a life-threatening illness and the only option is to use that drug, you do want it available and you don't want to have to wait a day or two to get it. So, you know, how we do that in a way that doesn't harm patients is a critical challenge.
All right. Well, thank you for those questions. We have a web question from Anya, a really good one, who says, what is overuse? Putting antibiotic cream on cuts? Taking antibiotics for ear infections twice a year? What if you're trying not to use antibiotics much at all? Can you still pick up the resistant bacteria and cannot fight it? Dr. Bell?
Yes. So that is sort of the tricky piece of all of this. You know, it was mentioned earlier that these traits of resistance, the ability to fight an antibiotic off amongst bacteria, is able to move. Many of these traits are carried on mobile gene elements, and those things can move from organism to organism, from one type of organism to another. And when we think about the types of organisms we're challenged with, as opposed to the thing that causes an ear infection, you know, or infects a cut, in many cases, what we're talking about are the bacteria that we all carry. This is the family of organisms called CRE, or carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, that includes bacteria like E. coli. These are normal bacteria that we have to have in order to have a healthy gut. If we don't have them, then we can be exposed to other diseases like C. diff that I mentioned. And so we can't get rid of them. We do carry them. And if we start to carry the version of E. coli with that resistance trait, the downstream effects are very, very problematic. If you think about something as commonplace as an E. coli urinary tract infection, As a clinician, you might see, you know, a couple dozen of these in a given week. And normally what you can do is document that there is, in fact, a urinary infection and write a prescription for a standard antibiotic to treat that organism. And the person is back at work after lunch and is probably feeling fine by dinner time or the next morning. That is very, very convenient. If there's a significant possibility of that bacterium being resistant, then all of a sudden the patient gets redirected to a hospital where they need to have an intravenous line placed that they might have to have for several days. That line is used to infuse an intravenous medication, very inconvenient with possible side effects, et cetera. You know, it changes how we practice medicine a great deal.
And we're almost out of time, but just quickly, Dr. Bell, what about antibiotic hand sanitizer that so many people use? And when you walk into a lot of grocery stores nowadays, you can use this stuff.
So those aren't antibiotics. Those are antibacterial in that they kill bacteria, but they kill because they're a harsh chemical. They're basically alcohol. And so alcohol does not trigger traits that cause bacteria to resist alcohol. The alcohol just damages the organism completely. And so we don't see a resistance problem there. In fact, doing a good job with hand hygiene is one of the ways that we can keep resistance from spreading, especially in healthcare facilities, schools, and places like that.
And I encourage everyone to go to our website, yourcallradio.org, for more tips on this. 30 seconds, Dr. Bell, any other tips or final thoughts on what you'd like to see change in the near term?
Well, you know, this is our probably last best opportunity to change course. Before long, if it doesn't require all bacteria to become completely resistant. All it takes is a small proportion of them. And if you can't treat the infection after the car accident, if you can't prevent infections in cancer patients or intensive care patients, then many, many parts of modern medicine become difficult to use, if not impossible. And we're going to see a major loss of medical capacity.
And final thoughts from you, Patty?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just really, obviously this hour has been great to expose all the different things. There's a lot of threads to this problem, but there is one very obvious thing we can do, which is to stop digging a deeper hole and creating more resistance with the way that we use these drugs and overuse these drugs to raise animals for food. That is a use that we can deal with. And so that is, there's legislation in both the House and the Senate that would stop the routine, that non-therapeutic use of medically important antibiotics. And so that's something we're pushing on. We need everybody just to be talking to their elected officials saying, enough. This is one way we can tackle this problem of antibiotic resistance. We have other work to do, but this one is so obvious, and it's a huge portion of the drug use, and it's a huge portion of what's driving this resistance.
Patty Lavera is Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, and Dr. Mike Bell is Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. Thank you both for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How can we break the stranglehold of big money in politics? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig about his mission to get money out of politics. He recently announced plans to start a super PAC to end all super PACs. His goal is to raise enough money to elect politicians who will vote to reform the campaign finance system. So what do you think is the best way to get money out of politics? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.